The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
But there's hesitation to kind of get entangled. It's a little bit like the US in the early years of its history, kind of being concerned about entangling alliances. Having said that, we've seen India over the course of time, for example, become much closer to the US. But that also means it's not going to give up, for example, its relationship with Russia. It's continuing to try to engage China, much as the US has. It doesn't want to leave its security to another country. Doesn't want to depend on another country. So even though we don't have the kind of blocks of the Cold War, this element that India should, or Delhi should not have to look to Moscow, if Washington is making a decision, for example, to go to war in Iraq, India shouldn't be obliged to do it as well. That's kind of the thinking behind very much trying to stay independent on that side. And so far, geopolitically, they've had the luxury of doing so.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 24th, 2015. That was Tanvi Madan you just heard, fellow and director of the India Project here at Brookings. With President Barack Obama on his way to India early next week, we asked Tanvi on the show to preview Obama's trip and discuss what we can expect from the president's second India summit in less than 4 months. It's a trip that comes with much fanfare. It's the first time that an American president has been invited as chief guest to Republic Day, and it's also the first time an American president has visited India twice. But can we expect the results to match the hype? What can be done to advance the bilateral relationship on trade, defense cooperation, and regional integration? And what role does India play in the broader U.S. strategy in the Asia-Pacific region? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 107, Tanvi Madan on the future of the U.S.-India relationship.
All right, so President Obama is on his way to India. I guess by the time people listen to this, that'll be a day or two away. What's he doing there, and what are the sort of big issues that we're likely to hear about him dealing with while there?
He's going to consolidate a relationship that's been getting closer over the last three administrations since the end of the Clinton administration towards kind of the 99-2000 period. Since then, the relationship between the U.S. and India have been getting closer and closer, but it's not anywhere near. I mean, India is a partner, not an ally, and it's very specific about not being an ally. But having said that, the U.S. is now one of India's closest partners in very many ways, including on the defense and economic side. President Obama he was invited by the Indian Prime Minister to be chief guest, actually the Indian President, but really by the Indian Prime Minister and his government, to be chief guest at India's Republic Day, which is the anniversary of the date India's constitution went into effect. It's a major honor. It's never been bestowed upon an American president. It's a signal that the Modi government in India, the new Modi government, which took office in May, is very happy about bringing the relationship with the U.S. out into the open and not just have things happen behind the scenes. Prime Minister Modi came here in September, and now President Obama will go and be the first American president to go to India twice while in office. There will be a number of issues that they will discuss. I think there will be a lot of symbolism in this visit, talking about kind of what the two countries share, democracy and diversity in particular. And there will be an effort on the part of President Obama to reach out not just and develop more of a personal relationship with the Prime Minister, but with the Indian people and make the case for why the U.S. is a good partner to have. On the substantive side, I think we'll see a fair amount of discussion on kind of four or five key kind of broad functional areas, and then some regional consultations as well. I think on the functional areas, climate change and clean energy, which is a major climate change being a major emphasis for this administration, a clean energy for the Indian side, we'll see, and I can talk about these in details, but just broadly, in the second area will be civil nuclear energy cooperation, where they'd like to see some movement from the deal that India and the U.S. signed back in 2008. The third area is kind of a very much kind of economic ties, business, trade and investment. Half a day is going to be spent with business leaders. Both Prime Minister Modi and President Obama will spend that time speaking with business leaders, both American and Indian, and to try to expand kind of that trade and investment relationship. Commerce Secretary Pritzker, USDR Mike Froman are going along as well, so it will be a major emphasis. The two other areas are security related. One is defense, the other is homeland security. On the defense side, in 2005, India and the U.S. signed a defense framework agreement, which is a document that kind of broadly encapsulated and framed the kind of defense cooperation the two countries would have, both in terms of how they saw it, but also in terms of how the two countries intended to take things forward. That was a time in 2005, and even in kind of that early 2000s period, where there wasn't really too much of a defense relationship at all in any manifestation. What we've seen kind of since then, and what was encapsulated in the document, there were various elements. There were kind of, one of the areas was regional consultations, which they have started doing, but not on a very systematic basis till very recently. The second was military exercises. And that the two countries have actually been doing on a fairly regular basis. One of the stats they like to throw out is that they do more military exercises with each other than anybody else. And this has been pretty much all the forces, everybody from the Marines to the Special Forces to Army, Navy, and Air Force. We've seen them, in fact, include Japan in some of these exercises on an ad hoc basis, Australia and Singapore as well. And one of the things that will be discussed is whether to regularize some of these kind of third country participations and to upgrade these military exercises. The second kind of area where we saw this defense framework agreement talk about various issues was kind of exchanges of personnel, thinking about this in a broader sense. And that there's been less on. There's been some discussion of having more contact, more regular contact between the personnel in both services. I think another area which there was, in fact, quite a bit of emphasis on, but there hasn't been that much movement on, is what's called the Defense Trade and Technology Initiative, through which there has been, the idea was for the U.S. to co-produce and co-develop military equipment in India. India has some indigenous defense production capability, but it's not been very well developed. It would like to develop that capability. Prime Minister Modi, in particular, is very keen on not just developing indigenous capability for the sake of not being reliant just on imports. A fair amount of India's military equipment comes from abroad. Today, India is the largest importer of defense equipment in the world. So I think he would like to do it not just for the sake of defense, but also to create manufacturing jobs at home. The problem so far has been Indian reluctance to sign on to some agreements that the U.S. requires for technology transfer, but also there has been some sense over the last few years that the Indian government's actions basically stalled on a number of fronts in defense. This kind of defense trade and technology initiative was one of them. Defense Secretary nominee Ash Carter was actually the person leading the charge on this. He sees this as a legacy issue. It's something that we might see movement on and more energy on, and there's already been a fair amount. Undersecretary of Defense Frank Kendall, who's the point person right now on this, is currently in India trying to finalize potentially some agreements to try to get some of this done. And then just finally on the defense side, sales, which we won't see announced during the visit. The two countries tend not to want to announce defense sales deals, but the U.S. has now become the second largest or overall in terms of share. It's become a major share, not anywhere near the Russians, who still have the maximum share of Indian military equipment that's being held. But over the last 3 years, the U.S. was the largest supplier in terms of dollar amounts to India in terms of defense equipment, and that was followed by Russia and Israel. Just on homeland security briefly, that's another area, counterterrorism cooperation, intelligence sharing, that's another basket of issues that there's actually been a fair amount of discussion on, especially since the Mumbai attacks in 2008. The discussions around these issues have generally been about concerns within India's region, but more recently, especially since the September summit, there's been some talk about intelligence sharing and more cooperation to counter ISIL and related violence as well.
So I want to go back to something you said right at the very beginning, which is that India sees itself and stresses that it is a partner, not an ally. This involves a sort of Indian understanding of its relationship with the United States that I think a lot of Americans find bewildering. You know, Americans look at India and say, oh, you know, largest democracy in the world, has a lot of the same enemies that the United States has. Relations should be very, very close. And generation after generation, they're less close than they seem like they should be. And I'm just interested for a long time, you could say, well, this is because of the non-aligned movement in the Cold War. But it's persisted in some significant respect. And I'm sort of interested in your general sense of the way India understands the United States as an international actor.
I think one of the things about that non-alignment and kind of that phrase did was it almost made it seem that the strategy that underlined it was very much a Cold War element in India's strategy. And that strategy, I think, is something that has been consistent in every Indian government, which is a strategy of diversification, which is the idea of being to kind of have as many partners as possible. And the reason behind it is to basically not be dependent on any one country too over-dependent. So there is dependence. I think the reality that it's an interdependent world, India is very much part of that world, quite dependent on the world, in fact, but doesn't want to, it wants to ensure that it is not dependent on any one country. The idea behind that was really, I think some of it stems from kind of India's colonial past, where it felt that many of the decisions that its leaders, including leaders that were part of India's independence struggle, could not take, were forced to take because they happened to be subject to decisions being taken in London. For example, Indian troops fighting in both the First and Second World War. And so what you've had is leaders that initially, and this has continued ever since, not wanting to be bound by decisions made in Washington or London or even Moscow for that matter. And so you've seen kind of this development of a broad set of relationships. Now, what that did is, yes, it diversified India's risks, but it also diversified India's kind of, it minimized the amount of rewards that India could get. India doesn't get the benefits of being an ally. It doesn't get the reliability that comes with it, though some allies say that there are questions about reliabilities even within an alliance. But this is something that India, it's kind of not quite, it's not quite a strategic taboo. India has kind of got close to an alliance. In fact, arguably, India had an assurance from the U.S. in the 60s right through the early 70s about against an attack, if there was an attack against from China, that the U.S. would come to India's assistance. I think that would, most people would think that that was coming close to an alliance. It's not how India would define it. They had a treaty with the Soviet Union in 1971 that also had language that would be very similar in most readings to an alliance, to what most of us would see as an alliance. But there's hesitation to kind of get entangled. It's a little bit like the U.S. in the early years of its history, kind of being concerned about entangling alliances. Having said that, we've seen India over the course of time, for example, become much closer to the U.S. But that also means it's not going to give up, for example, its relationship with Russia. It's continuing to try to engage China, much as the U.S. has. It doesn't want to leave its security to another country. Doesn't want to depend on another country. So even though we don't have the kind of blocks of the Cold War, this element that India should, or Delhi should not have to look to Moscow, if Washington is making a decision, for example, to go to war in Iraq, India shouldn't be obliged to do it as well. That's kind of the thinking behind very much trying to stay independent on that side. And so far, geopolitically, they've had the luxury of doing so.
So India is a country with a remarkable range of security problems. And if anything has pushed India and the United States closer together over the last 15 years, it is the overlap between some of those problems and others. From where you sit, how do they rank? There's a sense in the United States often that India and Pakistan overrate one another as actual security threats. How do you understand the sort of Indian constellation, perception of the constellation of threats that it deals with?
I think India sees, the Indian kind of security establishment sees one set of threats that's internal, related to insurgencies, but also terrorism.
So what are the active insurgencies right now?
There are some in the Northeast, but I think what's been of most concern in recent years, and it stems somewhat in the last year or so, is what in India is called the Maoist or the Naxalite insurgency, which is actually kind of feeds on a sense of inequality that people have of kind of being out of the system, but also sometimes a sense of kind of being left out or in some tribal areas, environmental concerns on that front. And so this has been kind of in central and East India, and every state has dealt with it differently, but there's also kind of a national action plan. It's not quite died out, but it's died down somewhat in the last year or so, partly because of the way the governments have been dealing with this, both state and federal. I think the other kind of internal kind of consideration has been terrorism. And I think that both the insurgency and terrorism are seen not just in an internal context, but in terms of India's regional situation. I think on the regional side and on kind of the external security threat side, I think Pakistan and China are still the two countries. The Indian military still plans for a two-front war. I think Pakistan is perhaps seen as the more immediate concern, whether it's problems at the border. There's been cross-border firing, for example, over the last few weeks, but also related to terrorism. I think on the eastern side and eastern north side with China, there's also a border dispute in place, and occasionally there are border face-offs when that situation flares up. It happened in September and this last year, and then it happened in April 2013. So none of those border situations have been sorted out. These are active border disputes. The one with China has been slightly more dormant. They haven't been nobody's been killed at the border in cross-border firing on that border, and the two countries have actually been managing it. They have an economic relationship in place that they are trying to grow. Whereas with Pakistan, I think there has been concern, partly because there's a sense about not being clear who exactly India can talk to in terms of its interlocutors. Indian governments have tried to support civilian regimes, so they tend to talk to them. But as a number of people, including our colleague Steve Cohen, has pointed out, the problem is that the deciders are not the civilians in Islamabad, but the generals in Rawalpindi. The other thing that kind of does worry Indian security planners is a kind of joint China-Pakistan threat, partly because of their kind of partnership that has ranged over time. This is less kind of in the sense, even though they plan for a two-front war, it's not so much that they're going to attack together, but what, for example, what kind of technologies China might be passing over to Pakistan, for example. There's been some concern in recent times about the nature of the Chinese threat. India kind of thinks of it more as a challenge, both in terms of China coming into its neighborhood and interacting economically and making inroads with its kind of smaller neighbors, not just Pakistan, but also in the Indian Ocean, as China says that it needs to kind of come into the Indian Ocean on a much regular basis because of its energy and trade interests.
So let's talk about that for a minute, because we spend a lot of time thinking about the East Asia maritime issues, South China Sea, East China Sea, but people think about the Indian Ocean issues much less. Has there been sort of similar Chinese aggressiveness in that area that has the Indian Navy particularly concerned?
not to the extent that they are, because there's not quite a maritime dispute as there is in both the case of the East China Sea and the South China Sea. But there have been concerns, for example, when the MH370 disaster happened, Chinese ships going into Indian waters, which were seen as quite an assertive move because it was done without warning, and even after the ships were told not to come into the area, continued to come through. Those kind of things are just a manifestation of kind of a general concern. There's been some concern when, for example, a Chinese submarine docked in Sri Lanka recently. So kind of more sense, there is kind of this idea of a string of pearls idea that a number of people, defense analysts, actually downplay and think it's kind of exaggerated because it's seen more as kind of Chinese port construction. The question tends to be more, at some stage, could China expand their presence in those countries in a way that's more threatening? So it's not so much China actually claiming waters or islands, but a sense of its creeping presence into the ocean, and in some cases a debate in India about what that really means for India. The two countries actually do joint anti-piracy. They're part of an anti-piracy coalition, so it's not like they aren't familiar with each other, but there is some kind of concern broadly about what increasing Chinese presence, but also increasing Chinese naval capabilities will do. Will China, the question being, as China's capabilities increase, will it want to do these things more? Will it be more threatening?
It's one of the, it's from my point of view, one of the most opaque relationships in the world. I mean, these are two countries that are economic rivals in some sense. They cooperate on all sorts of things, and they have a border dispute that occasionally involves shooting at one another. Is there a general way to characterize the Indian-Chinese relationship, or is it just very specifically issue by issue at any given moment?
I think in a broad sense, it's actually a little bit like the relationship that the U.S. has with China, which is that there are elements of cooperation, there are elements of competition, and there are elements of potential conflict. For India, it looms much larger, of course, because it sits right up atop India. This is a country that India has actually lost a war to. So it's not, Indians don't consider this a theoretical possibility. It's kind of always there at the back of the mind. So you do see an Indian approach that is somewhat like the approach that many in Washington have taken or advocated towards China, which is engage China, try to ensure that China sees the benefits of cooperation with India. But because there are concerns about Chinese capabilities and intentions, also prepare at the same time for the eventuality that China's intent is more hostile and less benign. And so that preparation for India has involved both external balancing in terms of developing relationships with the U.S., Japan more recently, Australia, and potentially with Southeast Asian countries as well as a internal balancing in terms of building up India both economically and from a defense perspective militarily. So we've seen kind of it's not an easy relationship to kind of characterize because there are all these elements. And as you said, there's cooperation not just bilaterally, but also in the multilateral sphere on issues like trade and climate change.
So let's go back to the India-Pakistan relationship, which is intimately tied to the internal Indian terrorism question, given that a lot of that is stoked from outside. It is also, of course, a nuclear standoff in a sort of ongoing way. And it has been remarkably static. In there's always this sort of hope that maybe now you can sort of have a kind of cooling of relations and or warming of relations, and it never quite happens. Is there any reason to think that the next 10 years will be different from the last 10 years?
I think the next year will be crucial in answering that question, partly because we saw one of those moments again in the summer when Prime Minister Modi was elected at his swearing-in ceremony. He invited Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and other South Asian leaders as well, and Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif accepted that invitation, came to India. We understood that the generals weren't that happy about it, but he came to or went to Delhi Nawaz Sharif didn't run an election a couple of years ago that targeted India. This was quite a change. He was actually talking about kind of forward movement. He was talking about economic growth and development. And so Prime Minister Modi, I think, reached out to Prime Minister Sharif partly on the grounds that this is something they could talk about, that both have development priorities, could actually work together, could develop an economic and trading relationship, that it could actually change the way India and Pakistan actually dealt with each other and created a different set of constituencies for the relationship. But what we saw since, and this says something about how Prime Minister Modi's approach as well is different, is that while he reaches out, he has very clear red lines. And if those are crossed, he pulls back from kind of this reaching out approach that he's taken. And so we saw, for example, the India-Pakistan Foreign Secretary level talks that were scheduled for August be cancelled because of a perception in Delhi that Pakistan had crossed one of India's red lines.
And what are the red lines?
There are the broader red lines about what the two countries would make them go to war. But there is also kind of minor red lines. And one of the criticisms of the Modi government action was that this red line seemed kind of not quite minor. But it wasn't quite clear that it was as big a deal. And what it was is the Pakistani High Commissioner meeting with Indian separatists, Kashmiri separatists, we don't know what happened in the talks between Sharif and Modi. We don't know if that was part of the understanding. But Modi, whether it's been with China or Pakistan, has kind of pushed back when there is a sense this kind of reaching out is being met with the other side perhaps taking advantage. But regardless, one of the problems in terms of the relationship with Pakistan is it's not quite clear if Modi is saying the ball is in Pakistan's court and Pakistan is not in a position, especially the civilian government, not in a position to move on that, it is going to be kind of stalled. The problem is what happens if there's accident or, for example, another terrorist attack. It's not quite clear that the Modi government will take the same approach that his predecessor did after the Mumbai attacks, even though it was very clear then and was backed up by U.S. information that these were attacks emanating from Pakistan. He showed great restraints, especially at a time, Manmohan Singh did, when this was 6 months before an Indian election. But it's not quite clear that Prime Minister Modi will take the same approach, that he will say, this is okay, I'm going to turn the other cheek. What we've seen recently is him at least conveying rhetorically and even during these cross-border firings that have been happening that they are not willing to turn the other cheek. I think one of the questions to ask looking forward is if there's an internal change within Pakistan, both in terms of regime but also approach. Are we going to see a real change after the Peshawar attacks? I think that will also kind of change the way India is seen. Unfortunately, recent moves have shown that it's not quite the optimism of kind of Pakistan understanding that you couldn't have terrorism, you couldn't be good terrorists and bad terrorists. It's not quite clear that that's filtered through. And so I think we'll have to see over the course of next year whether, of one, India can find an interlocutor. Second, how does Modi get out of this kind of impasse, because it's going to affect India as much as it is Pakistan. And third, what happens if there is a serious crisis, either within India in terms of a terrorist attack there, but also potentially in Afghanistan, where the two countries are interacting. And so far, that's not been in a very positive way.
And how would you characterize the interactions in Afghanistan?
There is Pakistani suspicion about the Indian relationship with Kabul, particularly with Hamid Karzai in the past. I think at the moment they've actually developed at least a working relationship with Ashraf Ghani, so that might be less of a concern. But there has been concern about basically Indian-Pakistani concern about the Indian presence in Afghanistan. There are these exaggerated figures of the number of consulates that India has there, which is not the case. But there is this kind of insecurity that India is going to have a base or have a large presence in Afghanistan, which is then kind of going to undermine Pakistani security, but also Pakistan's influence in Afghanistan. India, on the other hand, believes that Pakistan's concerns are exaggerated, that Pakistan's actually been undermining Afghani security. They're actually tend to agree with the Afghan intelligence position that Pakistan has been or Pakistan has been supporting the Afghan Taliban, or at least, even if not supporting it, offering it a base or looking the other way while it has conducted attacks within Afghanistan. This has been an issue, and it's actually touched upon U.S. Interests because the U.S., for example, and India partly kind of its opinions were shaped by the U.S., but did not, for example, contribute in terms of a military or police presence in Afghanistan. India has given $2 billion of aid. Has undertaken a number of economic projects, has also done some capacity building on the police side within India, but stayed away from providing, or had generally stayed away from providing military equipment or sending troops there, lest that be seen as Pakistan as in Pakistan as kind of having this, basically making their concerns true. This has partly been kind of something that the U.S. and India have talked about. They have a trilateral in place with Afghanistan. What's interesting now is the three countries that actually do have a somewhat of a shared vision of Afghanistan in the future, especially in terms of the stability, are China, India, and the U.S. And China is one country that has a different kind of leverage with Pakistan. And so one of the things that India, for example, is now doing actually has an official dialogue with China on Afghanistan, hoping that Beijing can shape both Islamabad and Rawalpindi's options.
So when you see the president go to India, all of these issues are in some very meaningful sense at the center of American concern. I mean, you know, terrorism is never far from the center of U.S. concern in international relations anymore. Afghanistan is certainly, you know, right up there. The China relationship is right up there. And what to do about Pakistan is, you know, probably occupied as much time in the White House as any other foreign policy issue, you know, over the last 15 years. What do you expect to see? And on all of those issues, U.S. and India have, to a large degree, similar, if not identical, interests. What do you expect to see in terms of the broader security relationship between the United States and India develop, both in the immediate aftermath of this trip, but also just sort of more generally over the next few years? Does it move closer toward what we think of as an alliance and less toward a sort of partnership by, you know, on certain issues? Or does it remain this kind of weirdly sort of arm's length, don't acknowledge how close it is? Where's it going?
I think it's interesting because you're absolutely right. They have a lot of, the U.S. and India have a lot of shared interests. But the problem in the past has not been that they've not shared interests. It's been that the difficulties have come when they don't share the approach in terms of how you actually get to those interests. It's been the means, not the ends, that they've often kind of stumbled upon differences. So I think some of it is going to be, and we're going to see more of this. I suspect we won't see as much because I think these are especially the regional issues, but also kind of counterterrorism, etc. We tend to hear less about in terms of the joint statements and the speeches. But I think what we will see is kind of, and we've already seen, a much more regularized set of consultations on these issues. In some ways, first even getting to understand the other countries' concerns and positions, but also seeing kind of the where they can actually work together, where there will be differences that the two countries can't bridge gaps, but at least try to manage those differences, understand positions, not get to the stage where these spill out in public and create a problem for the broader relationship. But even as these have been kind of factors, they've been drivers of the relationship. I think because, as you said, that they've shared interests. For example, you've seen India much more willing to talk about, which it wasn't earlier, how the U.S. and India have a shared interest in stability in the Asia Pacific. So earlier, India, as you said, was reluctant to talk about those issues. This new government has shown that it is willing to do so. It is willing to put in a joint statement with the U.S. Its position on the South China Sea, which is the same as that of the U.S., which it wasn't willing to do a year ago. I would say even the fact that the relationship was kind of hidden earlier, that was almost kind of the relationship that you didn't highlight, that you kind of hid or downplayed, the fact that Prime Minister Modi is not just invited President Obama to be chief guest at this ceremony that is very public, that is televised live across the country, But they're also doing, for example, a joint radio address together, which is unheard of. The skepticism used to be we don't want any external influence on our people. So these are kind of moves, I think, to show that there has been a shift in terms of attitude towards this relationship in India. I think on the U.S. side, there's been bipartisan support about kind of supporting India's rise because of many of those security considerations, because the idea is that that India might be more willing than perhaps some of the other allies to actually take on more of the burden of kind of providing security in the neighborhood. So I think overall, we've seen in the last 10 years already a significant shift, even the last 2 years, a shift in terms of what India is willing to talk about. Some of this is a question of necessity. India doesn't have a choice. The U.S. is the natural partner for it to discuss many of these issues. So I think so far we've seen kind of a major strides. We don't tend to see, India is not, I mean, this is not kind of a speedboat. It's very much kind of like a large ocean liner that's going to take time to turn. So the shift will sometimes be incremental. You will have to read between the lines. But I think on the security side, and you hear this from people who work the relationship, that it's already, whether it's on counterterrorism, discussing China, for example, having a U.S.-India-Japan trilateral, these things would have been unheard of a few years ago. So I think overall, this is very much, I think, the way that it was framed by the two leaders when they met last, that they both have a kind of a stake in each other's success, and part of that success is ensuring kind of security for both of the countries. So I think in that sense, we're probably going to see this, even though there will be differences, we will, I think, see this move in a positive direction.
One last question, then I'll let you go. One of the elements of Prime Minister Modi's success that everybody wondered about when he got elected and before is that he personally and the BJP more generally has something of a history of stoking internal sectarian tensions within India. How's he doing on that front? And how has the BJP's bark been relative, a bite been relative mm-hmm. to its bark on with respect to the Muslim minority?
It's been interesting. When the first speech that the Prime Minister made when he was, I think at that time, Prime Minister-elect, he wasn't even, when he won, he put out a message that said, that laid out what he thought his mandate was, which was to deliver to the Indian people a strong, prosperous, inclusive India that was respected on the world stage. We'd, for the first few months, actually seen him very much focused on the development agenda, saying and doing all the right things, not just about kind of religious minorities, but also speaking about women's rights, for example. We've seen, in fact, I think there was a turn in December where we saw not him, but people within his ministries, for example, cabinet ministry, for example, but also some of the people in what's called kind of in India the Parivar or the family of the BJP, which is associated organizations, including this group called the RSS or the VHP, where various associated individuals, and sometimes they were members of parliament, sometimes they were members of his cabinet, make statements that kind of conveyed that they did see India as a Hindu country and not the kind of multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multicultural, diverse country that's enshrined in the Indian constitution and the secular kind of India that's enshrined in the Indian constitution. We have not seen Prime Minister Modi speak publicly about that. We have seen him and his key some of his key ministers, some have spoken publicly about it. He hasn't. We saw them leak information that the Prime Minister was very upset about all this. But I think one of the things, and we'll have to see how he deals with this in the future, which is his silence, whether that suggests endorsement and endorsement of this kind of idea of India as a Hindu country, which most Indians don't agree with, or if his silence is basically for political reasons to kind of keep his, not turn his base away. His base reads it as endorsement. And I think this, we haven't seen the end of this yet. Some of this has tempered somewhat. In India, there's a vibrant media, and they've been keeping them on their toes by highlighting some of these instances. But I think we will see this more and more, and even though the opposition is not really in a in a very good position in the lower house of parliament and so can't say very much. They still do have more seats in the upper house of parliament and so can, for example, can shut down parliament as they did for some of these issues, which has a direct impact on Modi's ability to deliver on some of these economic policy reforms, etc. And I think that is related to kind of what he can do with the U.S. His economic goals, his foreign policy goals cannot be met if they get embroiled in these issues. And I think he will probably hear from most leaders and probably has when he came here that the idea of India that people support is not the exclusivist one that some in this kind of broader family of the BJP does, but that inclusive, diverse, multicultural, pluralistic India that's a democracy and has respect for its minorities. So I think we have to watch and wait. So far, the Prime Minister himself has not shown an inclination to go down that route. But yes, some of his supporters definitely have.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ben.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast on your social networks, Twitter, Facebook, email, Instagram, any other way you can. We'll really appreciate it. Thanks for listening.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.